Okay. Didn't Farrah, when she went through that song, just like it was an Alzheimer's test? Right? She did that check afterwards? Well, I really am very glad to be here, so thank you, Dorsey, for asking me, wherever you are. Oh, that's right. Before I start, I just want to say that I've been told many times that I talk very fast. And over the years, I've noticed people, there's two groups of people who talk about how fast I talk. People maybe under 40 tend to say, oh no, it's perfect, you know, you keep things moving, you're going great. And then people over 40, oh, slow down, we couldn't follow you, it was too fast. And the fact is, there's nothing I can do about it, because I have tried to slow down, and it just doesn't work. And one time I tried, and it was just like when you have a record and you try to slow it down, I was like this, and then boom, 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 boom. And so I'm just going to start, and I hope you can hear me, and I understand that I can talk fast. I was just thinking, coming over, my mom, who is the opposite of a tiger mom. You guys know what tiger moms are, right? Asian tiger moms. I'm pretty much a tiger mom, but my mom was not. And she, when I was growing up, the only thing she ever chided me about were three things. And they're the same three things my whole life. You talk too fast, you eat too fast, and you drive too fast. And before I drove, she said, you ride your bike too fast. So I'm like half a century later, I'm still there with all those issues. So anyway, so I'm really glad to share my story. The last time I think I shared my testimony, it was to a group of international students at the University of Michigan. And they were all seekers. None of them were Christians, but they were open. And it was really fun to talk with them, a totally different group, obviously. But it's always a privilege to be able to share about what God has done. So I'm glad to do that. Well, as you can see, I'm an Asian. I'm actually Chinese-American. I'm first-generation Chinese-American, which means I'm the first one, my brother and I, in our family to have been born and raised in America. My parents came to the United States. They fled Maoist China, Communist China. They went to Taiwan, and then from there they went to college and then came here for grad school at a time when there were very few Asian graduate students, foreign students. My father went to South Dakota State University, and he was engaged to my mother in college. And as soon as she graduated from college, she came and joined him. And 2 weeks after they got here, they got married, and my mom met her maid of honor the first time at the altar. My father's best man was his advisor in the university, and the host family's wife was the maid of honor from my mother. So they came completely with nothing except each other. 2 years later, they moved to East Lansing, to Michigan. They were doing graduate student degrees at Michigan State University. And that's where I was born. How many people know Sparrow Hospital in East Lansing? That's where I was born. And I just found out a few months ago that my mom almost named me Lansing. Because, you know, Lansing in Chinese, Lansing, there's Lansing in Mandarin, that's kind of a pretty name. And at the last moment, she changed it to Joanne, and I am so glad, because my husband is a Wolverine fan, and I don't think he would have married me if my name was Lansing. And I don't like that name, so that's pretty funny. Yeah. So when I was 1 year old, though, my father got a job as a professor in a small town in western Wisconsin. It was about 10,000 people, and it's all farmers or else all people involved in the university. And we were the only minority family, not only in the town, but in miles and miles. We were the only intact minority family. There was a white family that had adopted one African-American. There was one white family that had adopted two Koreans. There was one family that had adopted one Jewish boy, and one family that had adopted a Native American. And that was it. This was small-town America. Totally, totally idyllic kind of world, a church on every corner. Pretty much everybody was predominantly Catholic or Lutheran, a few Pentecostals, a few Congregationalists. But this is the world that I grew up in. And I look back now, and my family knew nothing about God, knew nothing about Christianity. There was no religion whatsoever. And we weren't anti-God. There was just, it's just like God did not exist. And if I were to trace back any kind of influence that was sort of a bigger philosophy, it would probably be just traditional Confucianism, which is what is not a religion exactly, but it's a philosophy of life. And like most Asians, Confucianism emphasizes education, learning, honoring your family, and then if you're really radical, it would involve ancestral worship. And that's where you get ideas of honoring your parents. That's where you get ideas of saving face. That's where you get ideas about shame and honor. And, I mean, that's many generations back. It's not like my parents taught me Confucianism, but that would be the kind of world that I grew up in. And it's kind of funny because in this very Christian world, we celebrated Christmas, but we had no idea what Christmas was. It was for us just exchanging gifts. I was part of the choir my whole life, and we sang all sorts of Christmas carols. They were not holiday songs in those days, you know. But to me, Joy to the World or Oh Come All You Faithful was the exact same thing as Santa Claus is Coming to Town. I mean, it just was all fairy tales in my brain, and I never made any connection about it. My first actual encounter with God is quite amazing because all my friends were baptized in their churches. All my friends went to confirmation, were catechized, and my only experience of them was telling me that they were busy on Wednesday nights and Sunday mornings, and I was the one who was free. And most of the time people complained, you know, about having to go to these things. But when I was 13 years old, a friend of mine, we were babysitting, and out of the blue, we're watching TV. She just turned to me and she said, "Do you believe in God?" And I think her Sunday school teacher must have told her to go witness to someone that week. So I was totally taken aback. I said, "Well, no, I don't even know who God is." And she said, "Well, I really hope you know, and I want you to believe, because if you don't, you'll go to hell." And I said, "Wait a minute, hell? Why would I go to hell? Well, if you don't believe in God, that's what happens." And I said, "Well, that doesn't sound like a good God to me. I've never done anything terrible. I was a very moral person. I was a very, you know, good student, that kind of thing." And so it made no sense to me. And I felt really sorry for her because I started asking her all these questions. "Well, if there's a God, why does this happen? If there's a God who's loving, why would he send me? Does that mean my whole family's going to hell? You know, I'm not like Hitler." You know, Hitler's like your get-out-of-hell-free card, right? He's the measure of everything. As long as you're not Hitler, you're never going to go to hell. So he was like my get-out-of, even then, I knew nothing, but he was my get-out-of-hell-free card. And I said, "Oh, I'm not Hitler, so what's going on?" And, you know, what could she say? She's 13 years old. And so she didn't say anything. But I was convinced I'd won that argument, and because I won the argument, then obviously there's no God, right? That's how it works. And I remember going home, and up till then, I would have called myself an agnostic, maybe, but I went home and I looked up the word atheist, and from that moment on, I called myself an atheist. And at school, whenever something came up in class or sort of an academic discussion, I'd say, "Well, I don't believe in God, I'm an atheist." And in our church, I mean, in our school, it's kind of like I became the resident atheist. And I remember I was in this social studies class. It was the biggest event of the year. We had these contemporary debates, and the teacher was very, very popular, so he would try to drum up a lot of sides for pro and cons of whatever debate we're doing. And the one topic that I drew was abortion. And this was 1976, 3 years after Roe v. Wade. It was still a very, very, very hot topic. And I didn't know this, but my opponent was Melissa Graff, who was, again, I didn't know, a very devout Catholic. Very smart girl. And so we ended up on this debate, and it was not even a big issue to me. It was purely an assignment. But this gal was so impassioned. She's so emotional. She was so invested in what she had to say. And in that moment during the debate, I just decided, you know what? That's crazy. And I just became even more impassioned myself. But it was more like an educational exercise. And by the end of the time, you had people crying in tears, saying, "No, you don't understand. You are talking about a life that you're giving up." And I was very much like all the feminists, in, you know, "Oh, no, there's no way this could ever happen." And my teacher was in heaven, you know. But it was quite a shock. And if anything, though, it made me cement more my own intellectual prowess at this kind of thing. So that was kind of my going along between 13, 14, 15 years old. Now, I was 14 and a half. Acquired, got a boyfriend, and now looking back, it's hard not to go, "Oh, isn't that cute?" But at the time, when you're that age, you think you're perfectly mature enough to have a boyfriend. And we were good friends, and he was a good boy. Turns out he was religious, and I didn't know that. And he began to argue with me a lot about the music and the dances and the movies that I was seeing and he didn't want to see. And I didn't agree with him, but we would argue, and he started taking me to this Bible study for teenagers. And I'd sit there and listen, but then I would start asking questions I don't see how this could be, I don't see how that could be. It was pretty awkward because it was really for Christians. But I went and I just wanted to give my peace of mind. You can see I was a real pleasant person in that way. But and then at the end of the time, you'd have this time of silent prayer where everybody would pray. And I was a respectful person, though. So even though I would ask questions and challenge, during that time, the whole time, I remember I would say to myself, don't laugh, don't laugh, don't laugh. Because I thought it was so embarrassing that people were sitting there and talking to God, that there'd be this silence, and people would be going around talking to a person who does not exist. So that was sort of my mentality. In the summer that I was 15 then, my boyfriend Tom said, I have a sports camp that I'd really like you to go to. People come from all over the country, and it'd be a lot of fun. And I said, well, I that sounds good, but it's, you know, sponsored by my church and the church college. I said, oh, I'm not going. And he said, no, really, there'll be no religious things at all. It just happens to be church. And I said, okay, I'll go. So we had to drive to Minneapolis, which is an hour away, and about 20 of us were going to drive 10 hours to Iowa, where this camp was. And we stopped at the house where the parent chaperone was leading, and as we drove up, there were five of us in the car from Wisconsin. As we drove up to this house, we pulled up to the street, and across the street, someone pulled into the driveway of the chaperone's house, and this gal got out of the car, and I didn't see her. Her back was turned to me, and I had the most out-of-body experience. It was like an electric shock went through me. I couldn't see her, but everything in me leapt towards that person that I couldn't see. And I was completely drawn like a magnet. And I've never had that experience since. And I was not that kind of person. I was very independent. But this happened, and I didn't know what was going on. And she went into the house, and the house was crowded with kids, crowded with parents, getting ready to send off their kids for the week. And I went in there, and I followed her into every room. And I saw her. She looked very normal, but somehow I just wanted to be in her presence. We got into three different vans to drive the 10 hours. I pretty much forgot my boyfriend at that point. I was just manipulating to get in the same van as this gal. And she got in a van. I made sure I got in her van. I sat two rows behind her, and I stared at her, the back of her head, for 10 hours. But I was super happy to be in the same van as her. And I, you know, it's not like I was analyzing it. It was like just compelled to be near this person. We got to the camp, and turns out, of course, there was mandatory vespers. There was mandatory night prayers. And I had a big fight with my boyfriend. I didn't see him for the rest of the week. Turns out I end up with this gal in my same prayer group at night, and her prayers, that people would have different times to pray, and she would pray these super embarrassing prayers. I was appalled on her behalf, you know. They were very personal. They were to Jesus, whom I had never heard someone talk to Jesus. I'd only heard people talk to God or to the Father. And she was very, very personal. I was not attracted to that, but I was listening. So through the whole week, I would just follow her around. I'm sure she saw that I was a shadow, essentially. But she didn't pay that much attention to me. Turns out she was 19. I was 15 at the time. She'd already graduated. She was on her way to college. So, you know, that's like a decade, or it's a generational difference at that age. So anyway, at the end of the week, though, I started getting really nervous, like I'm never going to see this person again because she was from a different state. And I said, okay, at the end of this week, I'm not going to see her. What am I going to do? So I did what I've never done, but every high school girl does, and I wrote a note. You can't go through high school without writing a note. So I wrote my little note to her, and I swallowed my pride, and I just said, you know, I don't understand what it is about you. I know I'm not going to see you again, but I really respect you. I think I said something kind of lame like that. And she wrote back and just said, everything I am is because of Jesus. I hope you'll read the Bible someday and understand. And that's all she wrote. So I went home, and the weird thing was I went back home, and, you know, my family, we were very, very close. And my parents, super loving, and my brother was one of my best friends, and he still is. So there's the four of us. And I always had this terrible, terrible homesickness when I would leave my home. And I write about that in my book. I talk about homesickness. And until I was 12, I could not leave home one night without going home. I would go to someone's house. It could be a slumber party. And the only way I could not go home was if I stayed awake the whole night. But if I didn't, every time I had to call home in the middle of the night I know, and my parents would have to come and get me. I mean, that was embarrassing. So I was very, very attached to my parents and my family. And when I got home from this camp, I remember sitting down to dinner with them, and I almost burst into tears because I felt so homesick, but it wasn't for my family. And I didn't know what was going on at all, and I was quite jarred by it. But again, you're 15, you're not sure what's going on. So I just said, I don't understand what's happening to me here. What could possibly be going on? I went to sleep. The next day, I remembered Mary. Her name's Mary. She said, you know, go get a Bible. I got on my bike. I rode my bike downtown to this little downtown area we have. We have this tiny little Christian bookstore that I knew about that I'd never gone in. I went inside, and I said to the lady, I've never read the Bible. I don't have a book. I have no idea. Please help me find a Bible. Of course, you can imagine, she was thrilled. And she's like coming over, and I brought my little prop. And of course, 1978, you remember the way? Living Bible? She gave me the Living Bible. See, I have it in here, Joanne Gow, August 22nd, 1978. That's the year that I wrote that in there. And she gave me this. She also slipped in there this Four Spiritual Laws. Do you guys know? It's a campus crusade little tract about four spiritual laws. And when I opened my bag, here was this little pamphlet, and I started reading through it. Okay, you know, I don't know what this is, but I'll read it. You know, Law 1, God loves you. Well, I don't know about that. You know, and you're a sinner. No, I don't think so. You know, number 3, Jesus. It's got this little hokey little picture, you know, of Jesus. Jesus, the cross, God and man, and he's the bridge to the two. And I'm thinking, no, I don't think so. And if you had seen me, I often think this, because we're such movie people now, if there had been a camera on me, I was just sitting in my room reading this. There's no emotion. I was like I was reading a comic book. It was like I was reading a book. I had no idea what was going on, except I'm flipping through this. And I'm sitting on my bed. And as I read that Jesus, you know, was the way, I had this experience where God just came to me completely. And there were words that came outside of me, but it wasn't like a voice. But the words were simply, and as soon as I heard them, I knew they were true, and it had always been true forever. And the words were, yes, I love you, and Jesus is the one. And that was it. And when he said that, I didn't really even have an emotional response. I just went, yes, that's right. Yes, that's true. Yes, I'm a Christian now. That's all I thought. And at the next law said, say the sinner's prayer if you believe, and go tell someone. So I prayed this prayer. Okay, yes, I believe now. And then I went, go tell someone. So I went across the room, across the hallway to my brother's room, and knocked on his door, and opened the door, and I said, Rich, I just want you to know that I've become a Christian. And he looked at me, and he said, well, that's good, because I became a Christian 6 months ago, and I've been praying for you. And he had completely on his own separately come to the Lord. And it was quite amazing, because someone had given my mother years ago a Bible that she never looked at. She just stuck it on a bookshelf. Turns out my brother, who was 16, I was 15, he had 6 months earlier, was bored looking at the bookshelf. He pulled out the Bible. He started reading from Genesis. And he said, if this is true, this is amazing. And he read Genesis through, and by the time he got to Isaiah, he said, I believe this is a God who exists. So at the time, though, I mean, I was totally clueless. He went, so I said, oh, well, good. And he said, yeah, good. Okay, goodbye. We shut the door, and that was it. You're not thinking, this is monumental. This is life-changing in every way. You know, we just kind of absorbed that. So that was my experience. The next day, this is the truth. I woke up, and my whole life was completely transformed. Now, I look back now, and I can say, no one told me, you know, to read the Bible, to fall in love with God, to pray, to evangelize, nothing. I knew nothing. But I did all those things. And it just because that's who God is, and that's what happens when he's in your life. And, you know, looking back, this is the most amazing thing. Now I have words for what happened to me when I saw Mary from afar. She was about from here to the back of that kitchen door. 3 years later, I read Luke 1. And do you remember in Luke 1, when Mary, who's with child with Jesus, comes to see her cousin Elizabeth? And do you remember when she greeted Elizabeth, Elizabeth said the baby in her womb leapt, and she was filled with the Holy Spirit. When I read that, I said, that is exactly what happened to me. I don't understand the theology of this, but this was, the Spirit just came and flooded me at that moment. And it was, I've never had that experience since, but that's what happened. Well, the biggest thing that happened, I feel like, though, and I can remember it very clearly, is over the next course of the months, I told everybody that I was now a Christian, and it was great because everybody knew me as an atheist. So you have a chance to really share what was happening. But one thing I never, never could grasp was that I was a sinner. I mean, this is how God is. He shows you his love. He allows you to come to him. But your theology is still very screwed up. And I remember thinking, but I still don't understand exactly why I would need to know God. And I was a junior in my history class, junior in high school, and I was sitting in my class, and typical Asian, you know, I cared about my grades, I cared about doing well, and I was in my favorite history class, and everybody loved this history class because the history teacher is wonderful, and he gave not only full points for your test, but he gave bonus points. And in my brain, I wanted not only to get the highest grade, I wanted to get all the bonus points you could possibly get. And that was my little idea. And my teacher would put up on the blackboard after every major exam, everybody's score, not their names, but everybody's score, so you knew where you were. And I always wanted to be at the top. And I didn't want just the 100. I want 106, you know. I want 107. So I was sitting in class. All the tests were handed back. I would never brag out loud. I mean, that would be verboten in a Chinese family to brag out loud. But inside, it was all there. And I saw, oh, yes, I got way better than everybody else. And I was very proud. I was kind of looking around. And it felt very familiar, this feeling of smugness inside. And looking at people and thinking, and it's not true, but I thought, oh, boy, I'm smarter than everybody. And this time, when I said it, it's just like thunderstruck. You are full of pride, and this is so ugly. And even now when I say it's like you have to have revelation how ugly that kind of thing was. And I suddenly saw, this is what it means to need. This is what it means to be rotten in the core, in the heart, not on the outside. And it was like the floodgates opened after that, because everywhere I turned, I saw my selfishness. I saw the way I spoke. I saw the way I thought inside. I saw the way that I had a temper. I saw the way I used my tongue. And none of it was condemning. I mean, I didn't feel shamed. I didn't feel terrible. I just felt really convicted. And mostly, I experienced joy. You know, that verse that says, you'll know the joy of your salvation. And when you repent, God gives life to your bones again. I felt like this incredible joy when I suddenly understood how much I needed God. Because we're always trying to tell people how much they need God, right? But you can't even manufacture that in yourself. I mean, even that, God has to reveal. I feel like I've seen that my whole life over and over again. Everything that goes on in my life, God has to even reveal my need and my sin and my blindness for him to come. So that was the biggest thing that happened. The last thing I just wanted to say is, since I've spent a lot of time now with Christians, and my own children have been raised in a Christian family, one of the most common things people say is, you know, I just don't have a conversion story. I don't have a dramatic story. I didn't come from horrible situation. And I certainly didn't. You could say that I have the untestimony, because rather going from desperate to God to joy in God, I went from joyful and happy to desperately and needy. You know, it's like I went backwards. So I often tell people, and I think this really for myself, that in some ways, if you've come from a Christian family, if you've come from a good background, if you've come from loving people, it's even more miraculous. It's even more, God still has to break through for you to realize that no matter how good your life is, he is so much better. And I was so content and happy with my life. I was so well-loved, and I still am well-loved by my family. And yet, when you encounter God, the love is so much of a different order, so much of a different quality and quantity. That is a testimony. You know, I can say I experienced everything good, and somehow God in his mercy didn't have to even bring me, have all this tragedy happen for whatever reason. He just kindly came to this very oblivious, very proud, very stubborn, smug teenager. I have two teenage kids. I have a 16, 18-year-old. I love them. They're fantastic. But I'm teenagers who are oblivious and proud. That's not a pretty sight, you know. And God has been so, so patient and so kind to me. I always think, you know, when I was growing up, there were three kinds of ice cream, right? There's strawberry, chocolate, and vanilla. And when Neapolitan came out, I just could not, this is genius, right? You open one carton and there's a slab of each. And I just thought, this is the most amazing thing in the world. And then a few years later, right, you come and you eat Ben and Jerry's Chunky Monkey. And I wrote this down. I went to my website today. It says, Chunky Monkey is the nuttiest, chocolatey, chunkiest concoction gone bananas you'll ever ape for in your whole life. And that is, to me, that's exactly what life is like. You have the best that humans have to offer in love, in family love, in romantic love, in goodness. And until you taste what God has for you, there is, you know, you will never know. You just have to taste it. And when you do, you can never go back. You can never go back. So the better thing will be replaced by the best thing. And so that's what I just wanted to say.
Wow.
Woo. Oh, yeah, sure.
You know, I looked at Joanna and I didn't know that whole story. It was great hearing that story. We have time for questions. If anybody has it.
Yeah.
What about your parents? That's it.
So my brother and I were Christians around, and as soon as I became, we both started talking to my parents. We made all the mistakes that children do at first where you evangelize and you're trying to get your parents to believe. They, you know, they were so unchurched, they didn't even worry about exactly what was happening. It's not like, oh my gosh, they've become Jesus freaks. Do you know what I mean? They knew nothing. And because we were already moral, it's not like those things changed that much. But I remember my brother, who's a fantastic man and Christian, but he got a little militant at different times. Like, we used to get the TV Guide, and one time there was, like, Charlie's Angels on there, and he ripped off the cover so that my mom couldn't see, and my dad couldn't see what he thought was a not attractive cover of Farrah Fawcett, you know. And my mom said, don't you ever tear off my cover of my magazine. And she felt judged, you know. So we made some mistakes in the beginning, but we... Over time, we just continued to talk to them, and they were not really challenged by our faith until we graduated from college and began to make choices that they didn't like. Because up till then, oh, good, you know, you go to church, you're good kids, that's wonderful. We didn't become really weird, but my brother was a scientist, and then he wanted to become a pastor. I was in economics, and I wanted to become a missionary, and that's when the rubber hit the road for my parents. So there was a lot of conflict at that time. But then over time, we worked through all that. And 25 years after we became Christians, my mom started going to church because my brother did become a pastor. And she started going to church every Sunday to be with the grandkids. But she was a captive audience. She heard my brother preach. And one day she came to us. She was 62 years old. We had not evangelized her openly in years because they'd heard it all. And you can't keep doing that with your own parents. And she just turned to me one day and said, Easter's coming, I want to be baptized. And there was no words for that moment, you know. And my brother baptized her. And she's a very devout Christian now. My father is, I would say he's open. He's 80, so I hope he starts making a decision soon, you know. So, but he's had miraculous things happen to him that are from the Lord, and we've told him, and he's seen them. But he's not in any, he works mostly in Asia. He's not around a lot of Christians, although he has Christian friends. So that's something we keep praying. But thank you for asking that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Does anybody else have any questions? And one of the things I love about your story is the power of prayer and the power of God's word. I guess I would like to ask, how many of you have maybe sons or daughters and you're concerned because maybe, you know, right? That's happened, right? Look how many hands are up. Don't stop praying. Never give up. Never stop praying. You know, I love it where, you know, it says in Scripture, ask, seek, knock, right? And if you go, what? Oh, the acronym is ASK, A-S-K, right? A-S-K. But it's not just a one-time ask or a one-time seek or a one-time knock. It's keep on asking, keep on seeking, keep on knocking. And even when you feel like, God, are you listening? He's listening. So never give up. Obviously, your brother was praying for you. That's such an awesome.
Yeah.
I wish I could have seen that, you know, on film when you're flipping through. Okay, I believe. Hey, bro, I'm a Christian now. Cool. Okay.
Well, I should say that my best friend in the neighborhood came from a family, a very devout Catholic family, 8 children, which in that time in our neighborhood was just crazy, right? The craziness. And a lot of the kids were not following the Lord, but the mother was a very strong Catholic. Her husband left her. Her husband left her with 8 children. They were dirt poor. But one of the daughters and the mother were really strong Christians. And when I, after I became a Christian, they said, "We pray every day for you and your family." And of course, there were people praying for us that we didn't know about, but they in particular had been praying for us. So thank you for reminding me of that.
Oh, yeah. No, that's great.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Give her another round.